A predator-proof fence at the northwestern tip of the South Island is the brainchild of Peter Butler, who has established the Farewell Farariki Nature Trust. Butler's natural health product company, HealthPost, which is an online retailer based in the Golden Bay town of Collingwood since 1988, has been supporting various environmental projects for years. Now, the focus is on the area from Farariki Beach to Farewell Spit, connected by the Pillar Point area and the cliffs of Cape Farewell. Take a look at the photos on our webpage if you do not know the area. And indeed, if you do not know the area, I asked Peter Butler to describe that part of the country.
Absolutely stunning. I say it's a privilege to work there because the cliffs and the beaches, it's windy as anything, but that just makes the vegetation somewhat horizontal.
Somewhat horizontal.
And that's interesting too.
Yeah.
And the people that are out there tend to be pretty independent, strong type of people that can handle a bit of weather.
When did you first decide that a predator-proof fence would be a good idea for around there?
It was an evolution. I was flying in from Auckland one afternoon and I looked out and the spit curving round looked absolutely beautiful. It's like a sickle shape from the air. You've got the wild Tasman on one side, you've got the calm Golden Bay on the other. And I thought, you could just put a fence across the base of that and Bob's your uncle. You know, it would only be about a kilometre. So I got back to the office and it was a kilometre. But of course, when the tide goes out, it's about 5 or 10 kilometres. And how are you going to fence into the sea anyway? But I approached Doc with the idea and there was almost immediate uptake. It was amazing that the whole thing has had such smooth sailing. I thought I'd run into bureaucratic headwinds, but when I described the idea, obviously not just we evolved from a fence at the bottom of the spit to, yes, it'd be good if you did some conservation work from there north because they were really big into partnerships at that stage and also fairly short of money. So it's just been a really good relationship with Doc.
Every time I'm up there, I see stoats. And I've been into Doc and said, look here, there's stoats, what do we do? And they said, look, we can't deal with all the parts of New Zealand, really. Here's a trap, virtually, is what they said. So you've done this trapping in this area and caught lots of stoats, right?
Yeah, the first time we put out a trap line was the 80 double traps. So there's two things that can go bang inside the trap. And the first time we put it out, we got 25 stoats, which when I tell other trappers about that, they find it hard to believe because, you know, they're happy if they catch, you know, one or two stoats. So the place is obviously riddled with them. And if you consider how many birds a stoat eats in a day, then, you know, that's a lot of birds. And the numbers went down after that, but we would still get half a dozen. And then early summer, again, we were in the 20s with stoats. But now it's all rats. There's been the mast year. And out of those 80 traps, doubles, we get maybe 140 rats.
Those rats are terrible. I was talking to a friend of mine who was driving through Lewis Pass the other night. And he was just going, boomf, boomf, boomf. Mm. Because there were so many rats just running across the road because of the mast year.
Mm.
So you're going to have your work cut out for you. You're trapping like crazy at the moment.
Well, you know, if we were emptying the traps more often, we'd probably catch a whole lot more as well. But we've got another 200 traps that we're going to put in. A good example of that is the recent bioblitz we had where there was a cave. These cavers went down. They were looking for cave wetter. This was just last weekend.
This was to ascertain exactly what you've got there.
Yeah, sort of baseline, you know, what are the... They know, you know, Doc's got a pretty good handle on the big stuff. So we know there's tens of thousands of wading birds out there. We know what big trees grow there, but no one had done really any study on the small stuff. So we got all these scientists together, a dozen or so specialists and different. There was a lichen expert, all sorts, but there were the cave wetter experts went down this cave, and the rats, just going back to the rat thing, it had been eaten out, so there were no cave wetters. There was just a lot of rat poo through the thing. Yeah. So
where are those caves?
Oh, a bit of a secret, Kim, but they are there. You wouldn't think so, would you? And a hint, you know, limestone, you know.
I know.
Yeah.
But you're not talking about on Whareroa Beach there? Not
no,
those caves?
No,
oh,
no, no, caves. No. These are sort of more like go down into caves. Well, mm-hmm. I went down in there. It was really interesting. What was lovely there was, which the rats hadn't, I guess they're too, well, they'd be on the roof of the cave, were the glowworms with their lovely threads hanging down. There's actually a picture of that, and just the light catching those wonderful threads, and I think they catch their prey with these threads.
So yeah.
For the first time, I actually saw one of these glowworms, sort of like a little. Well, it is a worm, really. Yeah.
So we've got pictures of the fence up on the website. Just describe it for me. How tall is it?
The fence, it's that sort of standard height, maybe a couple of meters. It's all stainless steel because you can imagine just the almost constant sea breeze right by the salt there. But it's a lovely sort of, so it goes across, Cape Farewell is the northernmost tip of the South Island, and it goes out like a rectangle out into the sea with these fabulous 200-foot cliffs on three sides, and then we've just put the fence across the fourth side, and it rolls across the hill, and then it has to go down the cliffs a bit. So to my eye, and actually a landscape architect who came along as the partner of the gecko expert that came for the BioBlitz, unprompted, and called it a wonderful environmental sculpture.
You realise that predators are going to nip around that fence and go down and up?
One of the north side is...
This will have occurred to you, right?
It's occurred to our trapping man. He's a little bit nervous about one end. One end is absolutely sheer cliffs that they're not going to be able to go up, period. There's, you know, crashing water. But on the other side, there is a little bit of vegetation that a very, very cunning stoat, if he did a lot of planning...
They are cunning.
They are cunning. And if it was full of little seabird chicks and he heard them and he was starving, he might work out a way. But... the other aspect to that, if there's a bit of vulnerability there, is to just have trapped the hell out of it. So we'll have traps everywhere around that vulnerability, and both inside and outside of the sanctuary.
All right. And the idea is to have a kind of halo effect. So once you can get established species on Cape Farewell there, that they will spread out, as it were, as long as you keep the trapping up.
That's right. So the master plan is that as we reintroduce the endangered seabirds and other creatures into the sanctuary, we extend our trapping from Whareroa Beach right to the tip of the spit, and we've got eco tours already trapping the spit. So between the two of us, we think it's feasible to make it effectively predator-free. There'll always be the odd one, but effectively. And if that happens about the same rate as we multiply the endangered species in the sanctuary, then there'll be this overflow from that. There'll be sort of a nucleus from which they can expand safely over the fence.
And what are the species that you want to stop being endangered?
Well, seabirds. I mean, everyone, we take seabirds for granted, but there's been so much publicity lately that so many are endangered. I mean,
Petrels? You want petrels there?
Yeah.
They're not endangered, though, are they?
Well, it's surprising. I mean, they call them at risk, is what they say. So,
right.
And we're going to test ourselves, or DOT will test us, really, with species that are at risk. Well, none of them are virtually breeding on the mainland. Like, there might be a colony of half a dozen somewhere sort of fairly inaccessible. But basically, they've been eaten out of the mainland. So, yes, they are out there on offshore islands. But our challenge is to bring them back onshore and create the seabird guano-based ecosystem that would have been through most of New Zealand pre-human.
Right, and based on the idea that the birds fertilise the ground and the ground can then grow better trees, because basically it's kind of a scrub around that spit area, isn't it?
Yeah, that, and also the... think of the invertebrates and the insects as well. So, you know, think of the tuataras going down those tunnels. And one thing about the BioBlitz that was interesting was having these moth experts and so on say how important to the... It's a little bit like plankton in the sea, I guess. And they were sort of saying, well, you know, if you haven't got the moths, you haven't got the basis for the food chain.
Yeah. That's interesting, actually, isn't it? Because we do tend to concentrate on charismatic megafauna and forget the small things that provide the bottom of the food chain.
Yeah.
How much did the fence cost?
$120,000.
Well, that's quite a lot of money, right?
Well, you know, you're not going to be able to buy an apartment with that, are you? You know, what are you going to spend money on? I mean, to me, it seems like if you can create a sanctuary with 120,000, I mean, it's quite expensive to reintroduce the seabirds as well, so that comes on
top.
How
are you going to do that?
The plan at the moment, the application is still in, so we've got a seabird expert doing all this stuff for us, which is great, Tamsin. But the plan at the moment is the application is to do fluttering shearwaters as the first off, and my understanding is that if we can get permission, they will be uplifted from Long Island in the Marlborough Sounds and helicoptered over to the sanctuary.
Uh-huh.
And we've got to dig holes. This is all new to me, so it's fascinating. It's a fascinating thing to be involved with. And I kind of love the way it's just unfolding. There's not a hell of a lot of planning and things going on. I mean, I'm not saying it's a roughshod or anything like that, but all of a sudden you've got to start thinking, okay, tunnels, boxes, how do you, you know, what's the plan for that? Who's going to do it? The local school's really keen to be involved. You know, obviously Doc help, but Doc have got their hands full. So essentially they're sort of throwing it over to us and sort of saying, well, yeah, if you reintroduce those, this is, you know, you go and find out about seabird tunnels and, you know, and work out who's going to feed them.
Do the shearwater tunnel?
Yeah.
Do they live in tunnels?
Yeah.
Burrows. So you have to, burrows.
Yeah.
So you have to dig their burrows for them so they'll like the real estate.
Yeah, so I'm planning to go and get one of those post hole diggers, and I'm thinking, you know, we'll just go in there and we'll start digging holes in the right direction and try and find out where the best spot in the sanctuary is to do that. I mean, I don't want to sound too amateurish, but there's an element of sort of making up as you go that I really like, because we're not getting caught up in bureaucracy and planning and things. We're just actually getting stuck in and doing it. And it's got quite a sort of a spontaneous sort of fun element too. I mean, even building the fence, there's a picture that I've given you of I mean, we just went there one afternoon with Solly's, the local contractors, Doc, Andrew Lamerson, wonderful can-do guy from Doc, and the fence builder, and we just sort of walked over this peninsula, and with some stakes and a sledgehammer, and people said, you know, somebody said, oh, well, I probably would go there, wouldn't we? And then Merv Solly would say, oh, that's a bit steep there. I think it'd make more sense to go over here. And the fence guy would say, well, we'll get it out of the wind if we do it over there. So in the course of about 2 hours, you know, the direction of what bit of farmland we were going to pinch off the leaseholder was decided, you know, and there wasn't any paperwork or anything. There was just stakes getting hammered into the ground.
Nobody's objected yet.
We seem to have got away with it.
One would have to say that this is probably what you've always liked about Golden Bay, is it not?
Western Golden Bay tends to be a little bit on the wild side, a little bit make it up as you go, yeah.
And you were a hippie back in the day?
Oh, absolutely.
Still a hippie at heart?
At heart.
And still doing much the same thing as you've always done, except possibly on a bigger scale. You know, growing things, watching things happen.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, I love growing things, yeah. And the whole plant thing's sort of interesting. That came up with the Bible too, because you know, you realise that it's not just about seabirds. The moth guy, you know, he's
the moth guy.
Brian. Yeah. Sorry, I should call him Brian. Brian Patrick. He's done 4,000 field trips. He's got his wagon loaded up so he can just jump in and do a field trip. He just does it. I mean, we went to call in seabirds. I mean, this some of it's as nutty as you like, and it's just fabulous. So we went out in the middle of the night. I thought we'd have a few beers after we'd met one another, but the chaps were all keen to go on out that first night and do stuff. And, of course, so Mike Ogle, the doc guy, said, let's go to the sanctuary and call in some petrels. So he had a battery and a great big searchlight, and we went up to the sanctuary. You know, we'd only finished fencing a day or so beforehand, shone the light up into the sky, and then made these sort of sort of whooping, like Indian whooping calls.
Are you sure you hadn't had a few beers first?
And well, we didn't call any petrels.
No petrels heard.
No petrels, but what was really interesting was going there. We went past this Brian Patrick, and just where you go up to Pillar Point, you'd know there's a bit of a pull away, and there's this incredibly bright light, and there's Brian Patrick with a generator and this incredibly bright light and all these moths coming, and there's him and his little maybe 10-year-old son with dozens and dozens of jars. And as soon as the moth landed on the sheet, they were jumping on. The boy was as fast as a lizard, grabbing all these wee moths and putting the lid on and then identifying them.
And so, then letting them go again,
yeah.
Hoping.
Well, right. maybe letting them go again.
Okay.
But he was able to identify all the vegetation and you know, what were the rare moths and what weren't. And you realise that, well, in terms of planting, we need to plant a corner of the sanctuary at least in vegetation that some of these rare moths liked.
What would have grown there originally? I mean, what is, if you want to recreate the vegetation, what are you looking at?
That's an interesting one, and just how much is it clear, and how much do you plant? So I asked our seabird expert, and she thought it would be about, you'd have about 2/3 planted and about 1/3 clear for the tunnels and things. And the other thing is, if you want to, because the birds have got to come, they sort of crash land, you know, and they don't necessarily want to crash land through big vegetation. So she was talking about one sanctuary, I think maybe Cape Sanctuary up north, where they've taken out flaxes and things to create a bit more bare land. So we don't want to overplant it, but it'll be sort of small scrubby stuff. I mean, there's the flax, it's called Farariki, interestingly enough, the mountain flax, you know, a low flax, the talpeta, the sort of the creeping coprosma, they're actually quite neat, these divaricating plants, you know, so those...
And they're probably always going to be quite low-slung plants, aren't they? Because, as you say, the wind there is pretty powerful.
Yeah, they're not going to be trees as such. I mean, over the fence, fortunately, is just over the nip of the hill, so it should be protected from the wind of a bit. But and we'll have probably the bigger flaxes, the tenax there, and maybe some cabbage trees and stuff.
What are the first birds you're going to put on there?
It's going to be fluttering shearwater. Yeah, so
there are some up in Farewell Spit. There's a gannet colony, but that's declining in numbers, right? Why that? I wonder.
It's incredibly vulnerable. I think that talks to the...
To predators.
Absolutely, yeah. If you go, they're about a metre above high tide line, and they're right beyond the very end of the spit. So, you know, as soon as I saw them, I thought, gee, you couldn't get further away from predators, you know. So at high tide, they're protected from predators. At low tide, they've got to defend themselves, I guess. And the other thing is, of course, if you get a storm event, well... You know, half the colony's been wiped out before in storm events. There's hardly anything nesting on the spit. And days gone by, in the 1870s, the locals used to go over there, they'd canoe over and they'd fill their canoes with baskets of seabird eggs. Well, you know, there's a few terns, there's the odd black-backed seagull nesting, you know, fairly fierce birds, a couple of oyster catchers, but... You know, and I had a bit of a difference with Doc early on because they sort of said, well, it's a biological desert. The birds that are there, well, not all of them, but there was that word. And I kind of thought intuitively, God, you know, pre-human, wouldn't it have been covered in birds? You had the Tasman on one side. You know, there was just so much food resource there. And so I was really pleased to recently read about these guys, the early settlers going and collecting all these seabird eggs, because I'm thinking, well, that sort of indicates it. And it's famous. It's a Ramsar site, so it's a wetland of international importance, the spit itself. But that's down to the wading birds, the godwits and the knots. And so there is a view among ornithologists that's the strength of the spit, and it certainly is. But
Not nesting necessarily,
yeah,
but passing
nesting.
Through.
Yeah, just right. Passing through, and they're not really threatened. You know, they just move in and out with the tide. But I kind of think, so our challenge really is to get rid of the predators and see if we can get seabirds nesting right, you know, because it's a massive area. There's 12,000 hectares when the tide's out. So if we can make that predator free, and it's naturally defended by the seas on both sides, so we've got one line of traps going, and you know, from one coast to the other. So if we're going to put two more lines there, and Zip is doing some fabulous experimental work and throwing some technology at it where you can start detecting invasive predators. So I kind of think it's quite achievable.
On the predator-free bit with the fence across it, I wonder what birds get on with other birds. Do you know what I mean? Like, they don't all want to live together. So what what species would you choose?
Well, that's interesting because there was a bit of a debate among the trustees because those gannets are threatened, you know, and we've got some wonderful cliffs.
You could make it a little house for the gannets.
Well, you could think that, but then...
But they get a... They're a bit pushy.
And Craig Potten, who's one of the trustees, was quite... He said, look, gannets are one of the few seabirds that's increasing in numbers. We've got limited resources. Let's focus on ones that are endangered. So
that's a fair call, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But it's tempting just to get a few gannet decoys and put them on a cliff further down the coast, you know, further away from our sanctuary, where we'll have the nice gentle birds, so that they can have at least a safe home. They are spectacular.
They're beautiful. When are you going to put your first birds on there then?
Well, the whole thing's moving so fast, Kim.
Well, it does seem to have moved fast,
yes,
Peter.
Yeah. So, you know,
it's only 2 years ago when you had the idea, isn't it?
That's right. And the fence thing's only been, I mean, only got finished last week, actually.
I mean, when I was up there last summer and you were talking about the predator-free fence and, you know, waving your arm at the horizon and describing it to me, I thought, yeah, right, you know, well, one day, maybe. Mm. I had no idea you were going to get on with it this fast.
No, I love the speed of the thing. And our seabird expert saying, look, if we could get the... And it's only a small area. It's only about 3 hectares. So we should be able to get all the predators out within the next, you know, in a matter of weeks. So we're actually, if the approval comes through, we'll be doing our introductions in January, probably.
This is quite exciting for you, isn't it?
Very exciting, yeah. I'm really loving it. Something new. And the other thing is I'm meeting all these wonderful new people. I mean, I had a...
The moth guy, Brian?
Yeah. Moth guy, Brian. But also,
Gecko guy?
Skink people, you know. I mean,
Skink people.
I mean, there's Alex Milne at Onikaka and his team that have been going up into the Cobb trapping for years. And you know, as an outsider, you know, because I'm new to all this stuff, you kind of think, oh, yeah, well, they're probably fairly boring greenies. But actually, you know, they're the most intelligent, well-meaning, lovely people that you could ever meet. Mm. And I went to, and we were talking about traps because everyone's got their idea of what sort of trap they want. And so I was trying to get a common trap because it's going to be a lot cheaper to build, you know, one design of trap. You know, so Paddy out on the spit, he wants single snap ones that don't go off. And then Alec Milne's got this idea. He's got his traps have got little alcoves and all sorts. They're really fancy. They're going to be incredibly expensive to build. So I was looking for some sort of common, rather affordable. I mean, I bring a business perspective to it a little bit. So I went to see Alex at his place and he said, look, come into the back room, have a look at this. And I went to his back room and he's got this box with netting over it and he's got the most gorgeous skinks. They're about twice the length of any of the household skinks you'd see, with great stripes down them, and he's discovered a hot spot for them. They're called Lonely Lake skinks, and he was about to send these over to experts at Te Papa or somewhere here in Wellington where they could do some DNA analysis and discover, you know, find out whether they are a whole new breed of skink. So there's a whole world out there of discovery and enthusiasm and, I don't know, saving the planet.
So you're saving this little bit of the planet through Health Post.
That's right.
That's all the money. So you've long given money to a range of projects, and now you're lumping it up a bit more, are you?
Yeah. It's been a transition. So sort of part of the DNA of the business. I mean, it's a family business, and you know, we are old hippies, really. I mean, so, you know, driving around in flash cars is not really our thing. So, and also I sort of looked at the Microsoft thing. You know, old Bill Gates, wouldn't have we all felt better about being ripped off with all those software programs that we had to buy for decades if we'd known that he was going to turn around and sort of stamp out malaria in Africa and stuff? So I thought, well, why not give money away while you build up a business, you know, make it an integral part of the DNA of the business. So we've done that. So every month we used to have revolving charities and would be a different charity. So we gave over $1 million in the end to these different charities. But then we realised that the staff and the customers, because it was revolving charities, it was all, you know, it was over 80 different things, different organisations. Number one, you weren't exactly sure that the money was being well spent. I mean, if you had a new one every month, there was a limited sort of looking at, you know, sort of examination of, you know, is this a kosher organisation, and you know, you just hope that most of the money gets well spent. Whereas if it is your own charity, you know, I can be a real tight ass. I can go around and you know, make sure that it is the most economical form of trap that we build and all that sort of thing. So bang for the buck. And also, given that the warehouse is based in Collingwood, the staff can really relate to it as well. So we're, it's our sort of neighbourhood, it's our backyard, and it's something that we can hopefully take our customers, our online customers, on a journey with too. You know, so here's the fence. We'll, you know, here's the fence, and then if we introduce the fluttering shearwaters, you know, that's great if that works. And well, I'm sure it'll work. But you know, there'll be some nice video content and things like that, and then hopefully we can build up to doing, you know, more endangered species and you know, and bugs and things.
And bugs and things.
Yeah.
Have you had the naysayers? I mean, there's, you know, there's some hardened characters up there. And I dare say that a few of them, I mean, I'm thinking of a couple in particular who would say, it's a waste of time. What are you thinking about? You know, it'll never work.
Well, it was interesting, actually. The first night of the BioBlitz, one of the naysayers, one of the sort of, he came and joined us. And that was a bit interesting.
You mean he turned himself around?
I tried to turn him around, Kim. I thought I could turn him around, you know, the whole 1080 thing and that. And I thought I was taking him on a journey.
Peter, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. Where did you end up?
He sort of stormed off, really. And,
oh.
Yeah. So so that was unsuccessful. But, yeah, no, just lovely to be with a group of like-minded people, and yeah, it was a buzz to get them all together from all ends of the country, Dunedin to Rotorua, Auckland, and we'll do it again. So we've got sort of a baseline. I mean, they found all sorts of that. We didn't discover anything new, which, you know, which would have been, but then again, it was just like a day and a half, so what can you expect? But we got some really good baseline. We extended the range of geckos, and you know, so we found them where we didn't think they would be found. They found a giant cockapoo, like it's about the size of a trout, you know, in the Whareaki wetlands. So there's the picture of that online.
You've done a lot of planting down that Whareaki River as well, haven't you?
Yeah, we have. Yeah, that's good. And again, a little bit of a difference with Doc, because you know, they, some of that, well, there's different elements in Doc. This is the really conservative element that really wants it to look pre-human, and I kind of think that's unachievable. And also, you know, why not try and, like, the human element is really important to me, that because that, say, that track to Whareaki Beach is just so popular, why not try and make it as spectacular and amazing as possible? So we worked the word wondrous into our memorandum of understanding with Doc.
How did you manage that?
Yeah, well, we just slipped it in, I think. So every now and again you put something up against wondrous. Well, will this be wondrous or not? You know, that's fairly open to interpretation.
Yeah.
But I want it to be kind of...
It's a high bar, though, wondrous.
I want it to be knee cows and, you know, just the trees full of birds. So, you know, bird food trees and things like that.
And you've been in partnership with the local iwi as well.
Yeah.
And they're fine with you putting wondrous trees in there.
Mana whenua ki mohua have been wonderful partners. Yep, and I mean, we had a dawn blessing. It was 5:30 in the morning for the fence, and this blew me away as well, because I thought it was going to be pretty much a health post thing. You know, I thought, well, we're going to put up the bucks. It's out, and I'm not used to sort of doing things, I think, you know, in a sort of a, I don't know, a community. You kind of think if you're going to do something, you've got to do it all yourself, you know. And all of a sudden, we have this dawn blessing, and Doc had done a wonderful job. You know, there's a hole dug in the ground. There's a little flax bag with a special stone in it, and people are talking about the stone. And people turned up at 5:30 in the morning. I had to sleep in the car at the car park to make 5:30 in the morning. Otherwise, everyone, you know, I mean, the school kids had come along from Collingwood area school, so I was really chuffed. And then Doc put on a spread at the nearby wool shed afterwards, and it was really, really warming, you know, that there is that much involvement and that much good feeling. So, you know, so I mean, Solly's the contractors, they went and did the earthworks for nothing. You know, the school is building the tracking tunnels. There's a wealthy Nelsonian who doesn't want to be mentioned, who's sort of come to the party. I kind of thought it would all be our money as well. And we got this old friend Chris Wheatley, who has done development projects, and he says, "Oh no, Peter, if you've got money, that's seed money, you can leverage off that money." And he's right. You know, you can, if you're putting up some money. Well, he's very good at it. He'll go to other people and say, "Well, we're doing this much. We're just a little bit short on what we need for seabird reintroductions. You know, can you come to the party for such and such?" And it seems to be working wonderfully.
Sounds like you started something.
Well, it's a lot of fun. Yeah.
That was Peter Butler, whose trust has established the Whareriki Eco Sanctuary, which will be officially opened on the 18th of January at 2 o'clock. All welcome, he says. I'm a patron of Peter's Trust. I should declare an interest.